From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Karl Marx and Marxist Philosophy in the 20th Century, this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Eugene Genovese of the University of Rochester and James Epstein of Vanderbilt University. Eugene Genovese is the author of Roll Jordan Roll, The World the Slaves Made, which won the Bancroft Prize in 1975. Eugene Genovese is at work on a forthcoming study of the life and thought of Southern slaveholders. James Epstein is the author of Lion of Freedom, Fergus O'Connor and the Chartist Movement. James Epstein is at work on a forthcoming study of labor and politics in 19th century England. Here is Eugene Genovese.
Marx, like every great thinker, did leave an ambiguous legacy. That statement could be made about Aristotle or St. Thomas Aquinas or Adam Smith. Now, what that means is that although there are certain basic concepts in Marx that you accept or don't, and if you do, you're a Marxist in a sense, and if you're not, you may be influenced by Marx, but I don't think you'd call yourself a Marxist. Nonetheless, for the most part, Marxist thought was very rich, and it did leave itself open to development along very different lines. So that we have many Marxisms today, some of which may be frauds,
yeah.
But many of which are quite legitimate in that they do derive from Marx's thought, but have developed it in quite different directions, so that you have in politics and in intellectual debate people who have every right to call themselves Marxists and who are at war with each other.
Okay, well, again, Wayne, Gene Genovese and Jim Epstein, let me see if I can get you to agree or disagree at the same time. What's at the core? Jim Epstein?
Well, perhaps before we say what's at the core of Marxism, I would like to add to what Gene said. I think Marxism is burdened in a kind of way in which most great thinkers are not burdened with a kind of legacy of interpreters, but after all, both a legacy of activists, political movements, and, of course, now political regimes. I mean, depending on how you divide the world up and what regimes you call Marxist or don't call Marxist, perhaps as much as a third of the world today considers itself to be, or the governments of mm-hmm. these countries consider themselves to be Marxist regimes. That puts a certain kind of burden upon the label Marxist, which, after all, to say you're a kind of an Aristotelian doesn't quite burden you with that kind of problem to determine how one is going to arrange oneself as a thinker or an interpreter in relationship between those regimes that have been historically created in the name of a Marx or Marxism.
Okay, well, given the fact that we are second guessing here after a fashion, what indeed is at the core? What fundamental ideas do we attach to this man's name? And how, in turn, have they been splintered and caused so much difficulty? Gene Genovese?
Well, it seems to me that the essential aspect of Marxist thought, which remains living and intellectually powerful, is his interpretation of history, and particularly his insistence on the centrality of social struggles in general and class struggles in particular, as being the, as it were, driving force in historical change. I think that those insights represent a very powerful body of thought. Now, at the same time, it would be pointless to call oneself a Marxist if one were not in sympathy with one or more sections of the great political movements that have come out of Marx's work. Marx was a socialist and a communist, and there is a distinction to be made there. Both labels are accurate. Now, It does seem to me that the reason that the modern Marxists continue to call themselves Marxists, taking the name of a discrete human being, which is a bit odd. It almost sounds idolatrous, and particularly for people who by and large are atheists, and one would have to wonder. But there's no secret to that. That is a way of identifying yourself with a Marxist thought in a general way. It doesn't imply that one regards Marxist thought as dogma, but identifying with that body of thought in a general way while specifically underscoring the continued commitment to the struggle for a socialist society, which of course was the burden of Marx's life's work. I might say along these lines that he was obviously a good prophet in some respects and not in others, but if you step back from it, it is clear that even the capitalism that has survived in the 20th century would have been unrecognizable as capitalism in the 19th century, and is to a large extent has proceeded along lines of collective behavior that have represented in a large part a response to the rise of socialism. To that extent, if you look at the capitalist countries, many of Marx's specific prophecies, of course, have gone by the boards. But his larger vision of the way in which the world has been going, it seems to me, has stood up very well.
It's interesting to me, Gene Genovese, Jim Epstein. Gene Genovese has just used the word vision. He's used the word prophets and prophecy. Why is he the enemy of religion if he is so passionately interested in the quality of our lives and the way, and in turn, again, what has become of his notions, his legacy? Jim Epstein?
Can I skirt that question for a moment, Wayne,
and
add 2 points to what Gene just said? First of all, I don't think that probably Marx's philosophy should be thought of as a kind of predictive science. First of all, I think there's a problem in the way Marx gets translated out of the German, in the sense that the word science for Marx and Engels doesn't mean what we quite now associate the word science. I mean, it's something, I think, closer perhaps to human knowledge.
Yeah, but these are methodological issues.
Well, they're methodological, but I think when people come to, you know, Marxism today and say, well, really this is a bankrupt theory because the predictive force of Marxism in some kind of way has fallen short of the vision of Karl Marx, I think that's probably the wrong way to go. I don't think Marx thought of this as a kind of predictive science that he was engaged in, and by the same token, I don't think that he ever discounted the subjective force in history, that is, real men and real women coming together, shaping their own lives, their own movements, and shaping their own societies. That is to say, it's very interesting in both Marx and Engels' work, there's no blueprint for socialism. And Marx doesn't say, well, this is the way it's going to look. Now, it's to be sure of their interpreters who go back, particularly into the early Marxist work, works like the German Ideology, and try to derive out of that what Marx's vision of a fully human society might look like. Marx himself does very little with this. I don't think Marx, you know, tried to say, well, this is the way it should or would look. Now, in that sense, I think he's not a, you know, not a religious philosopher. I don't think he's saying that there's certain kind of, you know, moral imperatives that are going to determine, you know, the shape of socialist society. I think he's very careful not to do that. The second thing I wanted to add to what Gene said is that there's a way in which, of course, Marx and Engels as well. I mean, it's often hard to talk about just Marx on his own. After all, he is to some degree involved in a partnership in his lifelong work with Frederick Engels. And the two of them are enormously influenced by the movements which occurred in their own lifetime. That is to say, there were, as Gene points out, there are many socialists that precede Marx, plenty of French socialists, there are English socialists like Robert Owen, who had a kind of vision, very often a moral and ethical vision, often something might even call a religious vision or spiritual vision of socialism. I think what Marx and Engels saw, particularly in the English working class in the 1840s, was the transformative agent, the historical agent, collective agent, namely the working class, that could create socialist society, and that this happened in a particular historical moment and under particular historical conditions. And I think they were very influenced by seeing a great working class movement, particularly the movement of English workers, the great Chartist movement, I mean, engaged in mass struggle to achieve political, social, and economic rights. And therefore, they saw, you know, they placed their socialist views within a historical framework. Now, you could argue, and I think it's true, that clearly the world proletariat has not been the universal transforming agent that Marx and Engels felt that they would be.
All right. Now, if we say that Marx was, what, a believer in history, he believed somehow in the notion of human progress, help me, Gene Genovese, Jim Epstein, to understand the relationship between Marxism and what appears to be a rather ugly word, determinism, the sort of inevitability of things. Have I got this right? What's right and wrong about that equation? Jim Epstein?
And I think there is that tension in Marx's work. I don't think it admits a simple answer. I mean, clearly there are strains in Marx's work which can be read as deterministic in the sense, particularly when Marx talks about, and even more when Engels talks about, laws of human development. There are tones in Marx which can be read, if they're taken, out of context, which give the impression that Marx could be seen as a kind of a determinist. I don't think that's the fullest nor the most intelligent reading of Marx's works, because I think there are other tones in Marx's work that show him not to be a kind of determinist in that sense. Nonetheless, I think in the 19th century, again, and I don't think Marx is alone in this, there's a very large project going on, a large intellectual project going on in England and Europe, trying to drive laws and principles. The most obvious example in parallel would be that of Charles Darwin. I mean, Marx and Engels were great admirers of Charles Darwin. Marx wanted to dedicate the first volume of Capital to Charles Darwin. Nonetheless, I think that that would be that would be a very one-dimensional interpretation of the Marxist inheritance to think of it as a kind of deterministic political and economic philosophy. I think Marx is saying, yes, that there are certain stages, there's a certain process of historical development that human societies, particularly in the West, have gone through. But I don't think that he's saying that this is somehow a predetermined or preordained
phenomenon.
And I think there's certain indications, for instance, in Marx's own life where Marx was interested in, the obvious example would be, say, his later writings on Russia, and things like his famous letter to Vera Zasulich, where he, for instance, articulates, is willing to entertain an alternative route to socialism, where he thinks, well, maybe Russia will not develop in the same way that he felt that England, France, and Germany were developing, that perhaps Russia rather than Western Europe would be the place at which a socialist revolutionary movement could be fully achieved in late 19th, 20th century.
Okay, well, let's follow up what Jim Epstein's been talking, the line that he's setting forth here. We're talking about Karl Marx, Gene Genovese, Jim Epstein, specifically with respect to the Soviet Union. Is Marx taking a bum rap here? I mean, he had no control over what Russian history and Russian officials did to his thinking, and yet we just slap that label, on the Soviet Union, and we make some blanket condemnations. Gene Genovese?
Let me preface my answer by following up Jim's and Marx. When Marx talked about socialism, and from time to time that unfortunate word inevitability will slip in, nevertheless, I do agree with Jim on the question of context, because Marx says very clearly that if the working class does not meet what he regarded as its historical responsibility to replace capitalism with socialism, it will face what he called a pro-slavery rebellion. Some people have interpreted that as a foreshadowing of fascism or Nazism. Well, whatever, but it was clear that he did not regard the victory of socialism as inevitable. What I think he did do, however, was to regard it as overwhelmingly probable, and that was because, given his analysis of the contradictions in capitalism and what would happen in the capitalist world. On the question of the Soviet Union, this, of course, is a matter of intense debate among Marxists as well as among others, and between Marxists and non-Marxists. There are many things about the development of Soviet society which very few Marxists are happy about. The Stalinist phenomenon is our great embarrassment. in the sense that the extent of the slaughter that went into the making is well understood. Now, one could make a very severe indictment of Soviet society for its repression of civil liberties, for its almost Byzantine political system, for what seems to be a perpetual crisis of legitimacy, and more than that. On the other hand, among Marxists, the debates tend to take certain directions. To the extent that the Soviet Union is severely criticized, and some Marxists repudiate it completely, this is put down to a perversion of the inheritance by Stalin. But perhaps more sensibly, to a historical analysis which points out that the socialism has so far developed in the most backward countries. Marx had pretty much assumed, with the important qualification that Jim mentioned about Russia, I would only add that it seems to me, in speaking about the prospects for a Russian revolution that would bypass capitalism, there's no reason to think that he separated that from the prospects of a revolution in the industrialized West. Now, what this has meant is that that socialism has been built not on the great accomplishments of capitalism, which Marx could wax almost romantically about. The Communist Manifesto was a glowing tribute to what the bourgeoisie accomplished on the level of material development. But it took place in countries which had to solve the basic problems of industrialization right at the beginning. I would also make the point that the Soviet Revolution was historic. It changed everything essential in the politics and social life of the modern world. And despite the indictment that could be made of Soviet society, the struggle to develop socialism has been, on many levels, a successful one. I find it rather droll that people who consider themselves Marxists and socialists are in favor of socialism except where it exists. I mean, you can find large sections of, you know, social democracy and the New Left and whatever, where they're all for socialism and it's the most wonderful system in the world. But then you name any country you want to name where it exists, and they're appalled. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that because of the problems that these countries have felt and have experienced in having to industrialize and solve problems nobody in the world dreamed our movement would have to solve, that it has been a very hard road. But that's quite separate from the question of whether the kind of social system they're building is not a social system that will evolve positively and be a model for a future world order. I happen to believe that, on balance, the prospects are good for that. Marx opened Capital with a quotation from Dante, whom he greatly admired, which said, in rough translation, follow your course and leave people to say whatever they damn please. Mm-hmm. Marx used that in the context of saying that he welcomed all criticism, all scientific criticism, all criticism based upon serious thought and appeals to evidence. And beyond that, he couldn't care less.
Jim Epstein, let me put the question to you in a little bit different fashion and press you perhaps personally here. What made you a Marxist historian? Was it the fact that you were writing about labor relations in 19th century England? What is it that, follow Gene Genovese's comments, what is it that you find engaging and appealing and applicable in your study of English history in Marx that's compelling for you?
Yeah. Well, of course, I'm in a little different position with regard to Marx's work than Jean's, in the sense that, of course, England was, in many respects, the center of the world development of capitalism in the period in which Marx was talking. Marx himself, of course, lived a large part of his life in England. Marx referred to England as the demiurge of the bourgeois universe. I mean, he's very much engaged in the workers' movements in England, and it's
lived in the British Museum. I hear something like
spent a long time in the British Museum. But I agree in many respects with what Gene is saying. First of all, I think what Marx gives one is Marxism places struggle and conflict, and the conflict between social groups. Marx called them classes, at the center of his work, at the center of historical development. And I think that's one thing, very important thing to derive from Marx's work, and it's influenced me very greatly, is the conflict between social groups are centrally important to the understanding interpretation of history. Secondly, and I think is very important in Marx's work, is what I would call kind of a holistic view of society. That is, Marx was interested in seeing the whole range of social relations within a given society at any given moment in time, how they had developed historically, and how they were in the process of development. So I would say that the question of struggle, class struggle, is centrally important to a Marxist interpretation of history. I would say this holistic view of social and economic and political relations. And also this notion of historical process is three of the central insights which Marx has made available to historians, and which certainly have been very important to my work on British working class political history.
Let me press you again specifically, Jim Epstein and Gene Genovese. A colleague of mine here at the Humanities Center has said if you really want to find out if somebody's a hardcore Marxist, you ask them if they got a will. You know, when you talk about property and the role of the state and the role of the individual and who owns what and who inherits what, let me ask you to reject, attack, defend, modify that sort of thinking. Gene Genovese?
It's a curious point of view that suggests that in order to be a Marxist, you have to be a damn fool. Now, you don't have to know much about the society you're living in to know that if you don't have a will, the feds are going to take it all when you go. Your friend is very witty, but I would like to think he didn't mean it.
Well, consider this question, this label of Marxism, from the standpoint of a comment one of our current, not an office holder, but he is a prominent public figure, a neoconservative, said, well, I resent the label, but I don't mind the company. Is that how you guys feel about being Marxists? Is that, does that allow enough of the complication to come through and stay away from the labels at the same time? Gene?
I'm almost inclined to reverse it. I have no problem with the label. I sometimes object to the company. Marxist, I was going to say movement, but it's hardly a movement any longer. You know very well that American Marxists are fragmented, and they're fragmented politically, ideologically, and in other respects. The same thing is true of just about every other political movement. Just to pick up a newspaper and see what's happening in the conservative movement right now, and we know very well what kind of disarray the liberals are in. I think here we have to recognize we're going through a crisis, and it's a world crisis, not merely an American one. It begins with an epistemological crisis, if we wanted to get fancy about it. Our own movement has suffered from this. On a world scale, obviously, when you have two great socialist countries like the Soviet Union and China keeping millions of troops on their borders because they don't trust each other, you know that you're in trouble. The fishers in the capitalist camp, however, while not quite as dramatic, are nonetheless deep. Now, in this sense, as academics, and Jim pointed out very carefully that we come to these problems from a particular point of view, and it's a rather narrow point of view, given the work we do and our place in our society. Here, it would be impossible to speak about a Marxist intellectual movement in the United States. We're terribly fractured, and sometimes it gets very nasty.
Let's conclude our conversation. Gene Genovese, Jim Epstein, I want you to be very brief and possibly anecdotal here. If Marx were sitting at a fourth microphone at this table, is there a question that you would ask him? Is there something that you're particularly curious about? Gene Genovese, how about this?
Well, my great problem with Marx is in his early philosophical work, which he never repudiated. He advances in that work a liberationist view of man. I mean, at the heart of it is the notion that it is possible through the overcoming of social contradictions, and specifically the class struggle in capitalism, to liberate human beings so that the contradictions between self and society will be minimized, if not indeed evaporated. And I think that was a terrible error. And on those grounds, I wish he had taken religion more seriously and studied the great theologians. God may not exist, but the original sin does. I'm convinced of that.
we got a Marxist, but a Calvinist.
I would ask Marx, in the light of the historical developments since his death. And remember, he was a man who always thought very deeply about his own views, measuring them against reality. He was by no means one of these people who sat around saying the same thing year after year. I would ask him whether he would be prepared to reevaluate that philosophical starting point, which I think has been an encumbrance and detracted from what I regard as his great genius as a social thinker.
Jim Epstein?
Yeah, I think I might ask him a more sociologically based question. I think it'd be interesting to ask Marx in the light of the last 100 years, how he would now see his theory of the relationship between the proletariat, the European working class, and its relationship to the transformative promise of socialism, in the light of the fact that modern experience seems to suggest that the peasantry in many countries has actually been the bearer of the brunt of much of the kind of revolutionary political movements of our century, and how, what he would think of that, and how he would now, rethink the kind of sociological basis of his theory of the agent of social transformation in the modern world.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about Karl Marx and Marxist philosophy in the 20th century. My guests were Eugene Genovese of the University of Rochester and James Epstein of Vanderbilt University. Both Eugene Genovese and James Epstein recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Marxism in the 20th Century, send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 404. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about 19th and 20th century American politics and jurisprudence. My guests will be Michael Holt of the University of Virginia and Michael Grossberg of Case Western Reserve University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Marxist philosophy in the 20th century, this week on Soundings. Listen for Eugene Genovese of the University of Rochester and James Epstein of Vanderbilt University. How did Marx affect Western politics? And what's become of the Marxist legacy today? Karl Marx and Marxist philosophy in the 20th century. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings.